I was discussing that the types of sins that God basically indicted Israel for. As I said, these are national sins more than individual sins. Of course, for there to be a national sin, there have to be a lot of individuals involved. And I listed six of them here, which are based on my own analysis. Somebody else might have broken them down slightly differently. But we got through most of them. The one that I didn't get to yet that I wanted to was God's condemnation, that's easier to write than to say, condemnation of Israel and Judah for trusting in foreign alliances. And I hesitate to call that a sin because it's not a sin to make an alliance with another nation, but God wanted his people to trust in him, look to him for protection more than to look at other nations. This should sound familiar because as we were going through the introductory chapters, it came up. No, actually, not the introductory chapters. It was during the narrative history. In chapter 7, the first part of that, I mentioned that how Judah was alarmed because Syria had made an alliance with Israel and they were coming to attack. And the king of Judah at that time, Ahaz, didn't want to trust God. He wanted to send to other nations for help. We covered that in Isaiah chapter 7. You can find it also in 2 Kings 17, verses 1 through 4. So, and I'm not going to go to 2 Kings and read it. Sorry, I should have mentioned this. I want to start in Isaiah chapter 30. Because what we'll see, and this will illustrate, is time and again, both the northern kingdom, but especially the southern kingdom more so, would look to Egypt for help. And we're going to see God pointing that out to them and saying, don't look to them for help, look to me. God, in a sense, is saying, I'm God, I'm all powerful, I can protect you, the Egyptians can't do what I can do. So they did look to Egypt for help. So let's pick up in chapter 30, where God is basically saying, you're in trouble, you're doing the wrong thing. Woe to the rebellious children, says the Lord, who take counsel, but not of me. They devise plans, but not of my spirit. God is saying, really, don't you think you should have included me in what you're planning? That they may add sin to sin, who walk to go down to Egypt and have not asked my advice, to strengthen themselves in the shadow of Pharaoh, to trust in the shadow of Egypt. Again, God is saying, I'm the one you should be trusting in and looking to. Verse 3, therefore the strength of Pharaoh will be your shame. The trust of the shadow of Egypt will be your humiliation. For his princes were at Zoan. His ambassadors came to Hanes. You guys all know where Zoan and Hanes are, right? No, those are towns in Egypt. And yeah, I wouldn't have known if I hadn't looked it up. And this seems to be implying when it says His princes were at Zoan, seems to be saying the Jewish king sent ambassadors. He sent princes down there. So the king of Judah has got agents down there in Egypt trying to arrange for help. And that's not what they should have been doing. It continues in verse 6. The burden against the beasts of the south, which is a bit of poetry and using imagery of animals. But in this case, the burden seems to have a different... The word burden, a different meaning than it usually does in prophecy. And I'm pointing this out because it seems to mean exactly what it normally means to us here. In most cases, when a prophet says the burden of the Lord, it means I've got a message I have to give you and it's weighing on me like a burden. In this case, it seems to be referring to people taking wagon loads of treasure down to Egypt. So it's an actual burden. As you see in the latter part of verse 6, they'll carry their riches on the backs of young donkeys, their treasures on the humps of camels. To a people who won't profit, you're taking loads of treasure down to Egypt, and guess what? It's not going to do you any good. And verse 7, for the Egyptians shall help in vain, to no purpose. And I'm going to skip ahead from there, but God is saying, well, I don't know how many times I should repeat it. Probably I have too many times. Don't look to them for help. You're wasting your money. I'm the one that could help if you would simply trust me. Let's go to the next chapter, chapter 31 of Isaiah. God's continuing this point in the first verse. Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses, who trust in chariots because they're many and in horsemen because they're strong. But do not look to the Holy One of Israel nor seek the Lord. Do our nations do that today, I could ask? And the obvious answer is, well, yeah, we build up our own armies. We form alliances with other nations. And that's not to say that that's sinful necessarily. Nations normally have arms and they cooperate with other nations. But just think, if the United States of America, if our people had a good, strong relationship with God, how much would we need to spend billions of dollars on armies? I'd like to think we wouldn't. Would we need to be a part of NATO and CENTO and CETO and all those other acronyms for military alliances? If our people truly had a good relationship with God, He could and He would protect us. We could pause and look at ourselves on that matter. As individuals, you know, we should get advice, we should get help from other people, but when we really need help, the first place we should look is to God. You know, and look to others secondarily, or let God help through other people's perhaps. But, you know, as God was saying to Israel, to Judah, don't look to those people for help and ignore me. God is saying, make me a part of your plans. You know, look to me first. And that would make sense. And I'm not saying it in this loud tone of voice because I think you're not doing that. Please don't take it that way. It's mostly because of the coffee and the getting ready for the break and all that. But it's good to take these lessons for nations. We can see ways that they would apply to us as well. And God has a nice irony, I think, in verse 3. It says, the Egyptians are men, not God. Their horses are flesh and not spirit. Yeah, we could say the same thing about guns, bombs, tanks. They're physical. They're no match for the power of spirit. But I like how God shows it. God has a sense of humor, and especially with irony, that shows up again and again in His Word that I've learned to appreciate quite a bit. You could say no matter how many forces come together or what type of military forces, if they're physical, they can't stand up against God. But God will defend His people. We're going to see now moving on in verse 4 of this chapter. God will defend and take care of them in a way that no other nation could. The Eternal has spoken and said to me, as a lion roars, as a young lion over his prey, when a multitude of shepherds is summoned against him, he will not be afraid of their voice or be disturbed by the noise. So like a lion fighting and roaring, says, so the Lord of hosts will come down to fight for Mount Zion. So when God steps in, he can do what those physical horses and physical chariots couldn't. So like a bird flying around, will the Lord of hosts defend Jerusalem. Defending it, he will also deliver it. So he sets up the defense and it works. God never fails. Passing over, he'll preserve it. I like that, as birds flying about implies God moves in quickly when he moves. But he's talking about defense. It made me think of aircraft coming in as air support. Maybe, I don't know, have you ever gone close to a bird's nest when a mother's sitting on eggs and they come down and start swooping at your head? Anybody? Okay, somebody's had that experience. I see that as like when God sets his hand, only it's not just annoying and a little scary. When God comes in, it's with power. I'm not sure if this is trivia, but there at the end of verse 5 where it says passing over it, the Hebrew there is pesek, P-E-S-E-C-H. It's the same word that was used for the Passover back in Egypt when the Passover was instituted. As in, God said, put the blood of the lamb on the lintel and doorpost because I'll come through and kill all the firstborn. But he passed over those that were devoted to him who had that symbol. Like I said, it could be just that it's the same word. It makes sense. But it's also worth noting that, you know, God's protection is that strong. It comes through in every case, as I said, for the nation as well as for individuals. Well, we want to turn back to chapter 10 to make a particular point next. I think God's condemnation of, you know, the Jewish people for seeking help from Egypt speaks for itself pretty well. I don't have to go look for more examples. But I find, again, interesting irony in the way God chooses to punish or chose to punish the nations then. Because he promises, okay, I'm going to punish you for doing, you know, all of these sins. But it's ironic that when it comes to the nations that they look to for help, God would end up using them in some cases to bring the punishment, and specifically Assyria and then later Babylon. Yeah, if you remember, as I said, King Ahaz looked to Assyria for help when he was threatened by Syria and Israel, and then later Hezekiah would do something similar. I've got the notation here. It's in 2 Kings 18, verses 13 to 16. Now, 2 Kings 18:13 to 16, Hezekiah sent tribute money to Assyria. You know, come and help me out. And the Assyrians said, great, yeah, we'll come. And then instead of protecting Judah, they conquered most of it as well. It's like, hey, look, they got a lot of money and gold down there. Let's go get it, it almost seemed. And there's where we see, you know, God planned to use those armies. I think I mentioned this before, but it's chapter 10, verse 5. He says, woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff in whose hand is my indignation. I'm pretty sure it was in this class probably last week or earlier. I mentioned that in our house, we talked to Connor about what we called the no-no spoon. So you say the rod of my anger, or in the phrasing we used to use in our house, it'd be Assyria is the no-no spoon of my anger. Don't look to them for help. God is going to use it as a tool. And that's what happened. King Shalmaneser of Assyria led the complete conquest of Israel. And then I mentioned later, his son Sennacherib would conquer much of Judah before God would stop him. And we saw that in chapters 36 and 37, where God sent an angel and caused Assyria to stop short of conquering Judah. But later he would make Babylon the rod of his anger later to conquer Judah. Yeah, let's look, while we have this open, in verse 15, God makes the point that the Assyrians didn't always realize that God was using them for his purpose. And they tended to think, hey, we're so great. If you remember the trash talk that the Rabshakeh made when he brought his troops up to the wall and said, oh, we've conquered all these other nations. Their gods couldn't stop us. And Hezekiah, you know, don't let him fool you trusting in this Yahweh. He's not going to protect you. You know, the Assyrians didn't realize that they were a tool in God's hand. But he makes it clear here in verse 15, he says, shall the axe boast against him who chops with it? Shall the saw exalt itself against him who saws with it? As if a rod could wield itself against those who lift up, or as if a staff could lift up as if it were not wood. God is saying, no, I was the one in charge. I was doing that. And that'll be the case with any of the others. And eventually then Assyria will be brought down. And of course, they would be conquered by Babylon in ancient times. There's this thought that there might be a modern fulfillment of Assyria oppressing and coming against God's people and then having to be conquered. And we see that as we look to verse 20. It shall come to pass in that day. In that day is one of those verbal signals that we're looking to end time prophecy. That the remnant of Israel and such as have escaped from the house of Jacob will never again depend on him who defeated him, but will depend on the Eternal, the Holy One of Israel. So when that time finally comes, the people will stop looking to these other nations, the other nations that ended up turning against them anyways. They'll look to God, and that's when they'll be saved. Looking ahead, I want to back up a little bit. Sorry, I jumped ahead to that, but it's verses 17 to 19 show the destruction of Assyria. So the light of Israel will be for a fire, and his Holy One a flame. It will burn and devour his thorns and his briars in one day, and it will consume the glory of his forest and of his faithful field, both soul and body, and they will be as when a sick man wastes away. The rest of the trees of his forest will be so few that a child may write them. So it's talking about vast forest, but such destruction that a little kid could keep track of how many trees would be left. If we are looking to end time prophecy and Assyria is going to be involved again, perhaps as being the rod of God's anger, but then also being punished themselves, it's worth asking, where are the Assyrians today? If modern peoples are in that place, who might they be? And I'll answer, we don't know for certain, but we have some clues that give us a pretty good idea. For one thing, Assyria was conquered by the Romans in the 600s AD. Or is it in 600s a Roman historian wrote about the Assyrians? Now I'm trying to remember which was right. Well, Assyria was conquered. Matter of fact, yeah, what am I saying? Assyria would be conquered by Babylon. They would be there, but later it seemed that they started migrating. Erase if you said they were conquered in 612. It's in 612 that the Roman historian named Pliny the Elder, don't you wish you had a name like that? I'm not sure if some people say Pliny, but I think it's pronounced Pliny, P-L-I-N-Y. He wrote in his history that the Assyrians began migrating, and that they moved north from where they were around the Black Sea and then started moving west into the area that we now know is mostly a Central Europe. Other historians also said that Jerome was a historian who wrote in the 700s AD. I think that's the same Jerome who was responsible for translating the Bible into Latin. But he said that the Assyrians had migrated into Central and Northern Europe. And thus, a number of scholars believe that many of the peoples now that are considered to be Germanic are descended from the Assyrian peoples. That's something that's been a belief in the Church of God for many decades. It can't be proven absolutely, but there's enough support to say, yeah, that's a fair likelihood. And it's a reason to look, you know, there for perhaps modern fulfillment of end-time prophecies that involve Assyria. And if so, what we just read about the forest being destroyed, think of Central Europe. They have some vast forests, like the Black Forest and the Bavarian Forest. I think the first time I went to Europe, that's one of the first things I saw. We landed in Frankfurt, and we rented a car for 3 days and drove around southern Germany and into western Austria, and I was surprised, like, man, they got a lot of trees here. But maybe not by the time Christ returns. Something to consider. I did want to mention, as I said in verse 20, where it says, in that day the remnant of Israel, such as has escaped, and we do understand there will be, you know, physical descendants of Israel that will survive the great plagues, the trumpets, and such. And verse 21 says, the remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. Verse 22, though your people, O Israel, be as the sand of the sea, and we could say the descendants of Israel are like that now, though they're that many, a remnant will return. They're not going to be that many left. For the Lord of hosts will make a determined end. And so they'll survive the defeat, you know, the destruction that might come from a modern Assyria, and, you know, be restored, and God will carry on. Okay, I think that's where I wanted to leave it, that. If you'll remember, yesterday I mentioned that God addresses bad leadership as a fault among his people in chapter 3, especially of Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 3, verses 1 through 7. So I won't address that. And Sabbath breaking is a problem that God addresses more in Jeremiah and Ezekiel's prophecies. The place in Isaiah that addresses it the most clearly is Isaiah chapter 58. But I'm not going to go into that because I'll save that for when we're going through the other prophetic books. Which leads me to the third type of message in the book of Isaiah. So the third type of message that Isaiah has that we want to look at is condemnation of other nations. We've been focusing on condemning Israel and Judah for their sins. And God was more specific with Israel and Judah. Why would he be more particular with those peoples than for other nations? They were his chosen people, and what did they know that the others didn't? Or what should they have known? Okay, commandments. They had his law. They had his government. You know, God chose them and taught them things, so other peoples were cut off. Sorry, I'm not yelling, but Israel and Judah should have known better. The other nations get a more broad condemnation. You know, they were still humans. They should have known right from wrong. So I'm going to give you a summary of where we can see some of these prophecies against the other nations, but we'll see eight different nations that God has messages against. Babylon, I say Philistia, usually we say the Philistine cities, you know, and that's Ekron, Gath, Ashdod, now I'm forgetting, there's five of them, and it goes down to four, but just say the Philistine cities. Moab, Syria, and it's addressed to Damascus in particular. Then Egypt, and sometimes Ethiopia is listed. Ethiopia and Egypt were often combined, sometimes separate. Edom, Arabia has a very brief prophecy, and Tyre, not the type of tire that's on your car that might get flat, but this one's, well, matter of fact, I know in Britain they spell tire this way, don't they? In Australia, do they spell it with an I? T-Y, so yeah, so this is not that. This is a city named Tyre. Okay, so I'm not going to go through all of these, but we'll take a sampling. So I wanted to give this to you so you could have the information. And I'm going to start at the end. We want to look at some of the prophecies against Tyre. So as you can see, for Tyre, we want to look at Isaiah chapter 23. And I could give you, well, there's a word that comes up when we talk about Tyre, because that Tyre was a city. And two cities are often considered together, Tyre and Sidon. So Tyre and Sidon sometimes appears, and these were what are considered Phoenician cities. I don't know why they couldn't spell Phoenician with an F, but it's with a P-H. P-H-O-E-N-I-C-I-A-N-S. So they're the Phoenician peoples, largely a seafaring people. Phoenicia, Tyre, and Sidon are on the Mediterranean Sea, further north than Jerusalem. Well, Jerusalem's not on the sea, but further north of Israel. Sort of in the area now that would be either Lebanon or Syria. And being on the sea, they do a lot of trade. They're a very commercially oriented peoples, and they made a lot of money doing that, which is part of what God will call them out for. I'm going to finally get to chapter 23 here. So it begins the burden against Tyre. Here's where burden has its normal prophetic message. It's a message for Tyre. It's not Tyre carrying heavy weights. Although the tires on your cars, if they're heavy duty, might carry a lot of weight. I shouldn't say stuff like that. I'll just cause confusion, right? Okay. But he starts off saying, "Wail, you ships of Tarshish." Well, what's Tarshish? Okay, this was another Phoenician city. So they had commerce with all their different cities, and there's different thoughts as to where Tarshish was. It's believed to have been from Tartessus, and we'll see next semester this will come up and be very important for one of the minor prophets we'll discuss. But I'm wondering if anybody remembers where you might have heard of Tarshish. It's prominent in the VeggieTales. Jonah. Jonah, when he was supposed to go to Nineveh but said, "I'm going the opposite direction," got on a ship to go to Tarshish. And Tarshish isn't on many of these maps. There's some thought that it might have been somewhere around here like Cyprus, but a lot of scholars believe it was in what is now Spain. Okay, so "Wail, you ships of Tarshish." Notice the focus on the ships. "For it's laid waste, there's no house to harbor. From the land of Cyprus it is revealed to them." Cyprus is, of course, an island in the Mediterranean and might be representing Western lands in general. So it's basically, "Wail to you, you're sending your ships all over the place, but, you know, trouble is coming." Verse 2, "Be still, you inhabitants." So it might be silence or a great surprise. "You're the merchants of Sidon, whom those who cross the sea have filled, and on great waters is probably referring to the Mediterranean Sea. The grain of Sihor, some people believe that's referring to grain from the Egypt, that's a city in that area. So they're trading over to Cyprus, down to Egypt, maybe as far as Spain, bringing wealth from afar. As a matter of fact, it says at the end of verse 3, she's a marketplace for the nations. But in verse 4, it says, "Be ashamed, O Sidon." I mentioned Sidon is associated with Tyre. Sidon was actually the original city, and Tyre was at first a colony. So, and that's a bit of history, maybe trivia, but they come up. Tyre became larger and more wealthy than the original city, Sidon. So it becomes the focus of the prophecy. But it all started with Sidon. Matter of fact, down in verse 10, yeah, "Overflow through your land like a river, O daughter of Tarshish." There's been some discussion. Some translations say daughter of Sidon because it's referring to colonies. But I'm not going to read all of the condemnation. But one thing it's worth, I forgot I skipped over a little bit of history or geography, because it's worth noting is that Tyre became two cities. There was a small island not far off the coast. So we would have old Tyre and new Tyre. Okay, and what had happened, God is going to predict destruction. Nebuchadnezzar is going to come and besiege and eventually destroy the city of old Tyre. But what would happen is they'd all pick up and go out to the island, and they still would carry on. And we'll see actually a more detailed prophecy in the book of Ezekiel where God says, "Look, Nebuchadnezzar did all this work, and he didn't get any plunder, so I'm going to give him Egypt so he gets some money out of this." Or he doesn't say it in those terms, but he says, "I'm going to give him his reward from Egypt." But eventually, old and new would be destroyed because many years later, and as I said, I'll go into this in more detail when we cover Ezekiel, Alexander the Great with his Greek Macedonian armies would come and actually build a causeway out to the island, and they would destroy new Tyre as well as old. So that's sort of the dynamic that's involved here. But I'll summarize verses 5 through 12 of chapter 23 show God causing destruction and alarm and grief for the people involved. Now I'm going to drop to verse 13, where he says, "Behold the land of the Chaldeans, the people which was not, for Assyria founded it." It's like, well, what are we talking about these guys now for? And then verse 14 jumps down to again saying, "Wail, O ships of Tarshish." Well, the reason we're bringing in the land of Assyria founded by, or the land of the Chaldeans, Chaldeans are Babylonish people. There's Chaldeans and Babylonians, and they're like, kind of like if you go to Switzerland and there's French, German, and Italian all in one nation. In this area, Chaldeans and Babylonians are two slightly different ethnic groups, but from the distance we're looking at, they all look the same. I'm not sure if that's a good way of putting it, but subtle distinction that doesn't matter from our perspective. But so you could say Chaldean and Babylonian are synonyms for our purposes. But what's Assyria have to do with it? The Assyrian who founded it. Historical reference, it seems, there was a person who founded Assyria, or the capital of Assyria, Nineveh, as well as Babylon. We'll meet him in Pentateuch class. Actually, if we'd have got a little further, we would have. Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord, was the founder of Babylon and of Nineveh. And so this might be referring to, okay, a Babylonian, a Chaldean founded Assyria, and those people are going to come and they're going to destroy, you know, Tyre. Now, again, we don't see a lot of, we don't see Tyre condemned because they're breaking the Sabbath. Or because they're worshiping idols. Not that God wants them to break the Sabbath or worship idols, but he's condemning them because they're focusing on wealth and they're in it for themselves and they're not playing nice with other people. Although not playing nice is not in the Bible, so that's sort of just my version of it. And again, punishment is coming. Let me go to verse 14talks about, "Wail, you ships of Tarshish." Moving on to verse 15. "It shall come to pass in that day that Tyre will be forgotten 70 years. According to the days of one king, at the end of 70 years, it will happen to Tyre as in the song of the harlot." We'll stop there and note, okay, the days of one king, most scholars of the Hebrew think that really should be one kingdom. The days of one kingdom associated with 70 years. And that's exactly how long Babylon was a major empire. They rose to prominence, overcame Assyria, and lasted 70 years before then the Persians conquered Babylon and took over their empire. So it seems to be saying, okay, the Babylonians will conquer Tyre, but then they're going to be defeated, and Tyre will recover, which they would for a while. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian emperor, would conquer Tyre, but they would go on out to the island and rebuild and start over, and they wouldn't be destroyed for good until Alexander would come later. Why do you have to know this? I sense that question in your heads. Or the question might have been, when are we going to start talking about another city? One of the things, I want to establish this because, you know, we're not in Tyre now, and there's not a lot of great revelation of what will happen in the end time. But we will see some prophecies against these cities that were fulfilled. And especially when we get to Ezekiel, we'll see some of the things that played out that God prophesied in advance that help us have the confidence that he does fulfill prophecy. And that's something we want to focus on. Some things God laid out that would happen in ancient times, he laid it out well in advance. He brought it to pass just like he said. And that's very useful because there's some things yet to come that are in prophecy that haven't yet been fulfilled. But we know God has always fulfilled his word. He's true to what he says. So we can, when we study Revelation, when you study some of those prophecies in Daniel, you know, the stone that's going to smite the statue on its toes and grow into a mountain to fill the earth, that hasn't happened yet, but it will. And the prophecies that have been fulfilled are vital for helping us to understand the ones that are yet to come. Yeah, I didn't finish verse 18. "Her grain and her pay will be set apart for the eternal. It will not be treasured or laid up, for her grain will be for those who dwell before the eternal to eat sufficiently with fine clothing." And we have some different views of that, but it seems to be perhaps saying that after Christ returns, you know, commerce and trade are going to be reestablished, but on right principles. It's not that trade and making money in itself is evil, But, you know, greed and malice and cheating people, those things are bad. If you'd like some other references, I have them here. There are some other places where there are prophecies specifically against Tyre. All these are in the minor prophets. So if you want them, this isn't something you'd have to have, but if you like to have a lot of chain references in your Bible, Joel 3, verses 4 through 8, a much briefer passage, obviously. That was Joel 3, verse 4 through 8. Amos 1, verses 9 to 10. Amos 1, 9 and 10. And then Zechariah chapter 9, verses 1 through 4. And having said that, I'm going to leave Tyre so I can stop making bad puns about tires. Go back to chapter 15, and we're going to look at some prophecies about Moab. Okay, and basically chapters 15 and 16 are mostly prophecies against Moab. Who were the people of Moab? I mentioned, okay, that Tyre, they were the Phoenician people, seafaring, you know, they're not related to Israel, but the Moabites are different. They are related. Well, if we look in Genesis, we'll see that Moab was a son of Lot, Abraham's nephew. So we want to remember both Moab and Ammon, and for that matter, Edom, are all relatives of the people of Israel. So we've got these family squabbles, we sometimes say. So the Moabites developed into a nation and actually were established in their place before the Israelites were a nation. But they're of the same ethnic derivation for the most part. You know, they're similar. And by the way, the peoples, we believe the descendants of Moab are probably mostly still living in the Middle East. The peoples perhaps of Jordan, many perhaps Palestinians. We don't know for certain, but it seems likely that's where they can be found now. So we start in chapter 15, the burden against Moab. So here's a prophecy against Moab. Because in the night of Ar, Moab is laid waste and destroyed. Ooh. Because in the night of Kir, Moab is laid waste and destroyed. Again, repetition there. Not looking good for Moab. Let's go down to verse 5. My heart will cry out for Moab. I wonder when I see things like that, is it that Isaiah is showing his feelings? Because, you know, when you see this destruction and people dying, it can be a little troubling. Or I sometimes ponder, is God using the prophet to show some of his own feelings? Because although God can be angry and God will punish when it's needed, I don't think God relishes that. God's not smiting away with a grin on his face and laughing because he gets to smite people. More, I get the feeling it might be that his heart is crying out, that it's sad, it's difficult. And I'll confess, I make reference to my family maybe more often than I should, but I think I get that so much more now as a father, because I have occasion to use that no-no spoon. Although now we keep graduating. I haven't moved up to Hot Wheel tracks yet. I say that because when I was a kid, I had Hot Wheels. And back then, Hot Wheel tracks were this long. They were 3 feet. I don't know when they went down to 1 foot. But my mom discovered that a Hot Wheel track makes a great paddle. And that's what I got used on me. Well, they were my toy. I remember I said, I'm going to take care of that. I'm going to hide them. I hid them all away, I thought. Now, she had one in her bedroom in her closet. But having said that, and I'm getting to a point, I learned this years later, you know, because my mom would punish, and I never got spanked that I didn't deserve it. I'm certain there were many times I deserved it that I didn't get it. But my mom revealed to my sister and I later when we were grown up, I'll get to you, Jacob, that she would sometimes spank us and make us go to our room, and we'd be in there crying. But what we didn't find out till later is that she would then go into her room and she would cry. Because spanking your kids hurts. You know that old saying, this is going to hurt me more than it hurts you? I never believed that as a kid. And to be honest, I'm not sure I believe it now as an adult. Because if it hurts me more than him, maybe I'm not doing it right. But it does hurt me. And when God is punishing Moab, God loves the Moabites. He loves the Israelites, but he loves the Moabites too. So maybe God's heart is crying out for Moab. Maybe. Again, this is a little interpretation. But so it's worth pausing there because remember, one of the points I like to make in studying the prophets is that we can get to know God. We can get to know him, his personality, more than we might in some other places. Anyways, there's some locations in the rest of this verse. His fugitives shall flee to Zoar. Zoar was south in the southern area of the Dead Sea, which is an area that could belong to Moab. So they're going, and it's a pretty desolate place, away from water and things. So they're fleeing. They're going where nobody wants to be anyways. Like a three-year-old heifer. When I flee, I want to flee like a three-year-old heifer. This is an analogy or a metaphor we don't know. It's a simile since it says like. But one we wouldn't use today, but it's basically saying a three-year-old heifer is in full strength and vigor. So you could say, if I were to say it now, it's like I'm fleeing to Zoar like a well-trained Olympic athlete. You'd understand what I meant now. That's what he meant by like a three-year-old heifer. And for by the ascent of Luhith, they'll go up weeping. Luhith was a mountain in Moab. In the way of Horonaim. Horonaim was also down there near Zoar in this broken, desolate wilderness. Yes, Austin?
Not to backtrack at all, but...
That's okay.
What is a heifer?
A heifer? Oh, it's a young cow, a female cow. Sorry. I guess that's not a common term these days either. Being a city kid myself, I'm not sure when I learned what a heifer was. Probably at Ambassador College, because the term shows up in the Bible a lot. Okay. Want to move on in verses 3 and 4, we see something that's within this prophecy to Moab, but we've thought there might be another interpretation in this. We're in chapter 16. Sorry, I jumped across the page. Chapter 16, verse 3. Take counsel, execute judgment. Make your shadow like the night in the middle of the day. So this is in the middle of God's punishment. Hide the outcast. Do not betray him who escapes. He's been talking about people fleeing, but then it gets more specific. Let my outcast dwell with you, O Moab. Be a shelter to them in the face of the spoiler. For the extortioner is at an end. Devastation ceases. Oppressors are consumed in the land. And it goes on from there in verse 5 to say, in mercy, the throne will be established. One will sit on it in truth in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking justice and hastening righteousness. I wanted to add chapter 5 because this idea of outcast and hiding them is set next to this throne being established. Now, this could all be an ancient prophecy just for ancient times. And many scholars, matter of fact, most scholars think that's what it is. And that the throne that's established, you know, is referring to Hezekiah strengthening the throne of David. And, you know, and the tabernacle of David is referring to the dynasty there. And that is quite possible, but perhaps if that's true, there's also a dual meaning. Because when we see the one, matter of fact, in my version of the Bible, one is capitalized, showing that it's not talking about Hezekiah. It seems that this might be a messianic prophecy of Jesus Christ, who will sit on the throne of David and things will be established. If that is a prophecy of Christ returning, perhaps the prophecies before that are referring to something that happened shortly before Christ returns. And I'm backing into this because this is one of the places we've looked at in connection with prophecies of protection for the church during what we call the Great Tribulation. And you've probably heard of that. Matter of fact, it's worth connecting. Keep a finger here if you turn over to chapter 26 of Isaiah. We'll cover this on its own later, but Isaiah 26, verses 20 and 21 are a prophecy, we believe, of protection for God's people. And this is one of the places we think we connect with the term place of safety. So in chapter 26, verse 20, come, my people, enter your chambers, shut your doors behind you, hide yourself, as it were, for a little moment until the indignation is past. For behold, the Lord comes out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. And so basically we know at the end time, God is going to punish the world. We see prophecies like this, like in Revelation 12, where the woman who we believe symbolizes the church is given wings to go to the wilderness for 3.5 years. And we've said, okay, God seems to be promising protection for people from that great tribulation. And then the question comes up, well, where is it? You know, and it's a legitimate question, where is it? Is it one place or is it several? For many years, the church was, you know, pretty settled in saying it's one place, it's a place of safety. And we paired that with what we see here in Isaiah 16, verses 3 and 4, and said, oh, it's somewhere in what was the land of Moab. Because it said, let my outcast dwell with you, O Moab, be a shelter. I feel like I'm trying to build up suspense, even though this is something you should have already heard of, but sort of building into it because you might not have. It's something we don't talk about and teach the way we used to when I was your age. Do you guys know where Moab is? For years, the church taught that the place of safety seemed likely to be in a place that's now called Petra, which is in what was then Moab. Have you ever seen images from Petra? Many of you have, probably in documentaries. If you've ever seen the third Indiana Jones movie, that's Petra. It was the place where they went to get the Holy Grail. Remember where the knight was there and he said, choose wisely, these buildings carved out of stone. Although if you go to Petra today, don't expect to find the Holy Grail. You know, the inside of that was a movie set. But what I'm getting at is we had this, I'm saying had this teaching. I don't want to put it completely in past tense because we've never disproved that there will be a place of safety or that'll be in Petra. We have just paused and said, well, wait a minute, maybe we've made the statement a little more strongly than we need to. You know, we believe God will protect his people. I absolutely believe that because it's in the Bible. But there's people of question, does it have to be in one place or might he protect us in a variety of places wherever we are? And I see both as possibilities. And if it is one place, where? It could be Petra. Matter of fact, I've often said, where is the place of safety? If God has a sense of humor, it's going to be in Petra. And I shouldn't say it that way because I know God does have a sense of humor, so maybe that's overstating it. But saying that it was in Petra was based largely on this scripture. And it could be, but I, you know, part of me says, well, that's kind of vague for saying we're going to buy airline tickets to go there, you know, when the plague breaks out. Do you guys follow me on this? And I'm curious, have you guys heard of going to Petra before? Because it was commonplace when I was young, and it's become less so over the years. And that's because it's not as, we admitted that it's not as certain as we might have thought. Okay, so, boy, I really thought I'd get through Isaiah 14 today. We're going to have to put this on hold. We'll carry on with some, we're not going to go through each and every one of these other nations, but we'll go through enough to be a sampling, and we'll zero in on Babylon, partly because we really want to focus on what it says in Isaiah 14, but that'll be after we come back from the feast.